Next speaker is Chiara Cappelletto. She's professor of aesthetics at the University of Milan in Italy, and also associate member of the CRAL at the Code des Hautes Etudes en Sciences Sociales here in Paris. And she will speak about from the title of her talk is From Res Publica to Selfish Reality Beyond Post-Truth. She has some problem with her voice, so she will help you with a handout with the text. I hope everybody has it. I think there are still copies there if somebody like it. So thank you. Thank you, Chiara.
So I apologize. I'll do my best. Hoping is enough. So I would like. I would like to begin by thanking Maurizio, Sara, Enrico, and Angela for organizing this day, which will help us reflect on how the regime of truth in public discourse functions in an age where one of its key players has changed in nature. And I refer to what rhetoric calls a particular audience. That is the group of people who are found to have a degree of socio-cultural consistency and a series of biases that are sufficiently similar for the orator to address them as if they were one person. The particular audience is not a natural thing. It is set up by the orator through a pact. The most emblematic example of it remains the opening of the Encomium of Helen, where Gorgias obtains his fellow citizens' attention by establishing with them that the highest virtues are strength in regard to the state, beauty in regard to the body, wisdom in regard to the soul, and truth in regard to the discourse, that he then relies on these to go against their opinion and demonstrate that Helen, the well-known cause of the Trojan War, is nonetheless innocent by offering arguments that to us seem absolutely valid but to them appear abnormal, depends on his argumentative ability. The rhetorical pact establishes a community of speakers who are free to agree with or not the arguments being presented. The French presidential opener, Mes chers compatriotes, still serves the same purpose. The thesis that I would like to propose you and discuss together is that if we want to take care of democracy in a period of high political turmoil, we do not need to look at the process of validation or relativization of truth with a capital T, but at its privatization. The major paradox of our time is that today's populisms are underpinned by the rupture of the radical pact and the emergence of a singular truth that is replacing communist opinion. The change in nature of the particular audience is certainly not due to the fact that people today are better or worse than they were before, or more or less ignorant, and so on and so forth. In fact, I'm wary of anyone who justifies the declining state of public discourse based on a banal reactionary sentiment of supposed barbaric societies. It has, however, been made possible by branches of the media that both produce and spread the discourse as such, and I insist on the expression media that produce and spread, rather than on social media or mass media, because, as I will try to demonstrate, these terms are fundamentally misleading and, in any case, obsolete. In fact, they suppose that real women and men, i.e. that we all, consciously share the same world through a common discourse, and there seems to be little evidence to support these assumptions. Let's start with the notion of post-truth. As we all know, this expression was chosen by the Oxford Dictionary as the word of the year 2016. It is, I quote, an adjective defined as relating to or denoting circumstances in which objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than appeals to emotion and personal belief. This term has had such impact because it institutionalized the relativity of truth in a specific context of the political polemic that characterized the British world during the pro-Brexit campaign and the American one during the last presidential elections. As the Oxford Dictionary wrote, I quote again, in 2016, post-truth has gone from being a peripheral term to being a mainstay in political commentary, now often being used by major publications without the need for clarification or definition in their headlines. We also suspect that some clarification is required. It is at the level of deliberative discourse that post-truth requires analysis, both for what it says explicitly as well as for what it implies. Post-truth affirms that the truth of things exists, but the knowledge of it is precluded or at least impeded by the domination of private opinions where emotional prevails. And I omit how such a position is naive, since it conceives emotions as antagonistics to reason rather than as factors that actually fully participate in it. And we have by now learned it from many studies in the field of neuroscience, and we should have learned it from ancient rhetorical treatises, and have in mind the passage of the Institutio Oratoria, where Quintilian speaks of the empathy an advocate needs in order to persuade a judge of his client's good reasons. In short, the idea behind post-truth is that no matter how much passions and personal interest unfortunately prevail, it is reasonable to hope that by patiently demonstrating how things really are, we will once again manage to act objectively in the real world, be it economically, socially, or culturally. It is therefore necessary to check the facts, and citizens are invited to fact-check, and the press, particularly the American one, is committed to do it, forgetting what Hannah Arendt wrote in Truth and Politics in 1968. I quote, "The mere telling of facts leads to no action whatever." It is, of course, based on the idea that there is a truth about things that can be found, that Carl Bernstein was able to coin the slogan according to which the journalist's goal is, I quote, "the best obtainable version of the truth out there," period. Although it is said by the champion of investigative journalism, I still do not believe it to be a position that better guarantees reality than the alternative facts of President Trump's counselor Kellyanne Conway. Both of them believe that fact exists, that the path to reach them is disputed, and that the truth can be obtained. The idea of post-truth in itself does not legitimize any form of relativization. If anything, it provides a literal conception of truth. We all can know it, by definition, because we can all access it. It is difficult to do so now. It is too bad. The idea of truth is, however, deeply ambiguous here, because it combines the universality of the truth of reason with the particularity of the truth of fact, the normative nature of truth with the empirical content of knowledge. We have known for centuries that the donation of Constantine is a fake, but it does not prevent Pope Francis from going on state visits to Italy and, of course, around the world. In short, post-truth does not provide us with the tools necessary to understand the difference between Watergate and the Bowling Green massacre, between something that really happened and requires to be discovered, and something that never occurred but is discussed. The truth about public things, once they are known, needs not simply to be admitted, but believed and shared. As Arendt wrote, I quote again, "Factual truth is always related to other people. It concerns events and circumstances in which many are involved. It is established by witnesses and depends upon testimony. It exists only to the extent that it is spoken about, even if it occurs in the domain of privacy. It is political by nature. Facts and opinions, though they must be kept apart, are not antagonistic to each other. They belong to the same realm, and this realm is, I believe, the realm of culture. and what is at stake in our times in the, is the understanding of its complexity. A statement that attests how things are, albeit correctly, still has to successfully participate in the polemic nature of discourse to be effective. This polemic nature is a world away from the mere contrasting of someone's positions, election debates between candidates, each convinced that they are in possession of the truth, are just a watered-down version of it. Saying that discourse has a polemic nature means saying that the truth we declare ourselves convinced by is shared, however hard it may to be swallowed. Discourse represents the mediation of conflicting interests. When this ability to agree across difference is undermined, more or less legitimate states of coercion appear. I think, for example, of prison, which is not just a place where a person serves a sentence after committing a crime, but a place that reifies the power of a judge to say what criminal offense, sure enough, a fact, was committed, and it is was committed by that person. This statement of mine is a minority opinion. I can be wrong, or we need to look somewhere else to understand what post-truth is. My argument rests on two points. First, to understand what it means for us to live in a post-truth era, we need to look at the context to which this expression owes its success, i.e. the discrediting of cultural elites with whom people were used to establish the rhetorical pact. Orators who want to be believed must be sympathetic, sincere, and reasonable. They must therefore know how to adopt the perspective of whoever is listening, credibly speak the truth, and do it in a reasonable way. The cultural elites are no longer associated with any of these three characteristics. The idea of post-truth, therefore, describes not the regime of untruth, but the regime of distrust in which the receiver of the discourse is found. Therefore, we can understand that speeches by politicians such as Farage, Grillo, and Trump do not quite encourage listeners to follow their own instincts, their own fears, their own ignorance. This analysis is, I believe, both superficial and condescending, because Farage's, Grillo's, and Trump's speeches do not legitimize the emotions of their listeners, but validate their faith in their decision-making abilities compared to discourse delivered by others. Such faith is no different from what Kant encouraged in What is Enlightenment, when he wrote, and I quote, "Enlightenment is man's emergence from his self-imposed knowledge. Knowledge is the inability to use one's own understanding without another guidance. This knowledge is self-imposed if its cause lies not in lack of understanding, but in indecision and lack of courage to use one's own mind without another guidance. Sapere aude." The first preliminary conclusion that I would like to propose is that post-truth does not refer to the status of the truth of discourse pronounced by whoever has the political and the legislative power to do things with words, but rather to the effect of the untruth on the mediated discourse to which listening citizens react by speaking out their truth themselves. The high turnout of Trump's inaugural ceremony is no more inconsistent than the presence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. What has occurred in the meantime is a radical crisis in the ability of the mediated discourse to represent the world. The expression post-truth means the decreasing power of cultural elites in producing and institutionalizing the truth. And yet, it was the cultural elites who coined the expression post-truth, not a coal worker of West Virginia, and they did not mean to be a j'accuse. If anything, it was a cry of desperation. This paradox can help us to understand the core of the problem. It is not that the cultural elites of Western democracies are unable to understand that the world has changed, but that the res publica, the multi-layered body capable of mediating different requests they represented, is now fragmented to the point where the political subject who speaks out publicly is decentralized and can be found at the margins of a world that does have any more stable center. Being a topic was Socrates' main characteristic. He was judged as decentered, extraordinary, strange, and alien by his interlocutors, by Alcibiades first and foremost. And he was. Yet, his discourse aimed at building a gnoseological scheme whose main quality was its universality. What we are witnessing today is a perfect and dangerous revolution. If we live in a post-truth era, it is not due to the old opposition between truth and politics or the role of untruth in the eternal struggle between the means and the ends, but because the way in which the contemporary public subject is established is changing. And I come here to my second point. I will draw on some contributions by the most brilliant American brains that are behind televised political satire. Those people know better than anyone what McLuhan meant when he told us that the medium is the message. According to Stephen Colbert, the status of truth is of truth, in today's public discourse is truthiness. He coined this term in 2005 when presenting his show The Colbert Report to qualify the truth based on which the second war in Iraq had been justified. I quote, "What I say is right, and nothing anyone else says could possibly be true. It's not only that I feel it to be true, but that I feel it to be true. There is not only an emotional quality, but there is a selfish quality. The subject speaking is no longer the impersonal one that Heidegger spoke of. The discourse is not acephalous, it is not the author that is missing. On the contrary, the one who is telling the truth is absolutely I. In online postings, there is a variety of heterogeneous and unassimilable individuals whose different I's produce normative affirmation about the world. The style of tweets reflect this. There is no need for the clause I think, I believe. People are addressing the world directly and confronting the world issues, the reality of things. The problem is that even if the authors of the tweets represent a majority of people, they do not share any esprit de corps. It is a numerical majority that does not correspond to the sharing of any collective political vision. For this reason, the notion of populism is a pseudo-concept, in this context at least. It is an elitist concept. We find ourselves trapped in a paradox where the speakers constitute a majority because they share the same communicative style, but they are not, at least for now, capable of exercising the power of the majority because their argument rests on the singularity of truthiness in contrast to communist opinion. What is at play here is not the reality of facts or the full understanding of it, but the sharing of one reality when there are various positions about it and different interests that exist. Dozens of reality shows have undoubtedly produced a certain permeability between the real world and fiction, so much so that in a 2009 famous essay, historian of performance art Carrie Lambert-Betty proposed using the category of parafiction to explain it. By doing so, we would find ourselves only adding footnotes to the problem of plausibility, while Aristotle already taught us that a plausible but false fact will be believed more easily than a true but hardly imaginable one. This explains why some months are needed to gather evidence of the Watergate scandal and why a brief remark was sufficient to produce a non-existing Bowling Green massacre. What is happening now is rather that all individuals believe themselves as capable of producing normative affirmations about the world that are true not because they are authentic, but because they are public. It may be that post-truth as customized reality, good for whoever wants to believe it, but the 140 characters of a message to all of humanity suggests an idea of country, polis, and world that is radicalized rather than incontestable. What is happening is not the good old relativization of truth, but the privatization of reality. In online postings, people speak urbi et orbi, feeling as if they are intervening in public matters. The post-truth world would be a place of ignored facts and dominant opinions. Our real world is one full of soapbox individual speakers. A variety of heterogeneous and unassimilable individuals are expressing themselves in this way, where each I speaks to everyone, so not for everyone. This phenomenon, which is to a degree hallucinatory, is often referred to as populism. Even though it remains vague about who is populist, the people or those governing them. If those who are speaking cannot assume responsibility for what they are saying, it does not matter who is speaking, but that they are speaking. This devaluation of discourse corresponds to devaluation of the very idea of the norms, according to which civilization learned to govern factions and tribes and constructed the linguistics games that are first and foremost linguistic, insofar as such norms are performed and not applied from outside. The world thereby ends up being subjectively reified. In conclusion, the problem labeled post-truth is that of certainty, which is built on the common ground that Wittgenstein found to be necessary and sufficient for it. I quote, "I did not get my picture of the world by satisfying myself of its correctness, nor do I have it because I am satisfied of its correctness. No, it is the inherited background against which I distinguish between true and false." End of quote. It would not be otherwise possible to explain why an obvious alternative fact, like that France was among the victors of the World War II, on which de Gaulle constructed his political life, was accepted and widely and wisely used, and we are all grateful it went that way. I am grateful. As Marx said, the philosophers have only interpreted the world in various ways. The point is to change it. I think that understanding it would be good enough. In order to do so, I propose that we go back to practicing rhetoric, the technique that is rooted in life and mediates through reasoning the polemic nature of men, sensible and rational human beings. The technique whose main objective is to persuade others of one's own reasons while granting them room for dissent. The extraordinary power of the art of rhetoric is not the opportunity to convince others, but the opportunity to regulate polemics. And I consider it the best possible introduction to the political theory we need today. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Yara, for this
great report. So, yeah, I hope you have still some bit of voices to answer the question. So, Maurizio.
Thank you. Thank you for the effort, and not only of speaking, but also of thinking what you wrote. I totally agree. I share your analysis. I'm not sure that rhetorics could be the real solution, but since I have no other alternative ideas, I cannot have any serious argument. Only a point in your analysis, because you said that post-truth is related to the decreasing power of cultural elite. This is a point that often appears in the analysis. But my question is, when the cultural elite had a kind of power in any sense? Because before post-truth, in the so-called ideological area, the power was of churches and parties and not of cultural elite. This is just...
No, you're right. Thank you for the question, for the remarks, so I can explain myself better. Let's say my sentiments is that they think they had it, the power of being really, of perform reality. So And somehow they are right. I mean, I think that there has been a cultural power of shaping communist opinion, and they now have the feeling that this kind of power is gone. So I could transform my statement more in a sociological one, if you want. I think there is a crisis in the cultural elite who does not trust itself anymore, somehow. So it's an internal crisis.
Professor Bogosian.
I'm not sure I really understand exactly the position you want to take. So there is the definition that the Oxford Dictionary gives. It seems to be correct as a description of the phenomenon we're experiencing. It's somehow or other, the role of objective truth, or the truth, is playing a less important role in shaping people's opinions, especially in the political sphere, than used to be the case. So that's the label. So the label for what the phenomenon is, and the thesis is that that is in fact going on now. That's why we live in the post-truth era. As I say, it's very important to not understand that in the same way in which we understand that we live in a post-dinosaur age. The dinosaurs really don't exist, but truth still exists. It's just that it seems to be playing less of a role. Now, you say that you don't think that that notion in any way legitimizes relativization of truth. But relativization of truth is one very powerful way in which the truth doesn't play a role in discourse. Because it turns out that the truth does not exist on a relativistic view. There is just your truth and my truth and their truth and our truth and so on. So I really didn't understand why in this important paragraph you say, you know, Carl Bernstein's view is no better than Kellyanne Conway's view. Carl Bernstein said there is a fact of the matter as to what happened and the journalist's role is to find that out. Kellyanne Conway says, well, you have your numbers, I have my numbers, and there really is no fact of the matter as to how many people there were, let's say, in this room today.
The point is, I do not believe that there are more lies or more truth under the sun today than before. And some... I do not believe that there are more lies or more truth under the sun today than before.
Under the sun, in the reality, it's an Italian way.
Sorry.
That may be, but certainly the more you lie, the more lies there are. I don't understand how there couldn't be more lies today than yesterday. Some more lies.
When I mentioned the donation of Constantine, what I meant is that some important lies have actually performed our real world. And what is going on with post-truth is not that... I mean, the war in Iraq was based on a huge lies. The war in Iraq was based on a huge lies. The political power of the church is based on a huge lies. Okay. So many real historical action facts and actions are based on gigantic lies.
Yes. That remark presupposes that there is truth.
Exactly, I'm perfectly fine with that. I do think there is truth. It's what I'm trying to say. There is truth. And post-truth is not undermining truth, because there is truth. And somehow the notion itself of post-truth suggest that we want more truth. We are nostalgic of having more truth. What is happening now is not that we have more lies or more truth or less truth. The point that what is happening now is the subject who is allowed to speak the truth is no more the institutionalized subject how was before, but thanks to the social media, if you want to call that that way, the plurality of subjects that think that can be acknowledgeable, and that they have the right to speak the truth for everybody else is absolutely enormous. So there is a hyper-composition of the public discourse where everybody participates in thinking of being able to state normative statement, which in fact they can be normative for him or for her, but do not produce reality. But the feeling that they do not produce actual reality because they do not have the political power to do it.
Now, I think this is a really important point, if I may, because I think that one of the key things you will find in this literature, and it's not just in Paris, it's also true in many departments of the United States, is a conflation of fact with what is widely accepted to be a fact. This is the key identification. See, this happens even when people talk about in the United States, even in journalism in the United States, they say, is evolution a fact or is it just a theory? Now, for somebody who's using fact in the proper way, there is no contrast between fact and theory.
Theory, sure.
There is theories, these are opinions, and they can be true or false depending on the facts. But when they say, is it theory or is it opinion, they mean, is it widely accepted to be a fact, as opposed to just something somebody says. But, widely accepted to be a fact is a sociological phenomenon. It's not about truth. Widely accepted to be a fact just means lots and lots of people believe it. Okay, and it is an interesting question why people believe something or why it gets to be accepted. And there can be a sociological story to that, but that's not about truth, that's about acceptance.
This is what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the fact that
it's run together with issues about truth and fact.
Because many people think they are now allowed to speak the truth even if they are saying what they think, what we call opinion. There is a mismatch of the two notions in the real world, outside the scholarship.
Professor Nina Rumelin.
I think this little conference here is interesting also because you have quite different positions presented. We had new representative of new realism, we had a representative of old realism, another one also more old than new realism, and now we have a representative of anti-realism. And I think this should be discussed openly, it's even the misunderstanding that it's not your misunderstanding, analytical philosophy is pro-realist, is not true. Here we have three analytic philosophers at least that are realists, it seems to me, but this is a minority, isn't it? In analytic philosophy, realism.
No.
Well, in philosophy of science, it's a tiny minority. The most analytic philosophers of science are instrumentalists and not realists. Okay, then we have a dispute internal. Now, what makes it clear that you are take an anti-realist position is that you say the elites have lost their capacity to establish truth. Nobody can ever establish truth. Yeah. So if you are a realist, you can never accept this formulation. So now the question is, do you mean they have lost their capacity to establish opinions widely accepted in society by their power position? That's then another view that's interesting to discuss. But
the answer,
one
yes.
has to add that good parts of the elites have given up the idea that it's about truth. So the last 30 years with neoliberalism ahead thought it's only about bargaining. Yeah? We all play a bargaining game and that's all. So it's not anymore about the truth. And the postmodernists said, well, it's not bargaining, it's a game of cultural identities and so on. It's not about truth. So these two points.
The first point is yes.
Yeah, okay.
The second point is, what I'm interested in is the fact that, and what I think is interesting in all the post-truth debate, from my viewpoint, is that before we had some, the number of the subject, of the epistemological subjects, allowed to speak out publicly were less consistent than what we have now. The fact that anybody can do it, is actually changing the notion of what is an opinion, what is a shared opinion, how we can intervene in the public debate defending an opinion. Is this dangerous for what truth is? Yes, it is. But I think that we should give more space, more room to the sense of power that any singular individual has about the fact that he can make an argument, even though this is not based on any ontological kind of presumptions, because this is what is changing democracy. So if we want to speak about democracy, I think that we have to understand who are the subjects that think they are allowed in participating in democracy, and how they think they can do it, and how mediated has to be or has not to be anymore what was called res publica. This is my whole point. I'm not arguing that truth doesn't exist. I do not believe it. I do not think it. And I'm not saying that opinions are more valuable than they were before. I do not think it at all. I'm saying that what is happening is a substantially changing in what the public subject is in its status.
Okay, there is one question, gentleman there, and then John Searle for the last question of the talk.
Yes, thank you. I really liked your lecture because it gave some new insights into this debate, and I really appreciate also the point that you make with post-truth is nothing really new. It's something that is really close, something to do with how the political society works and how power is distributed in our society. I have a question about this. You said there is some privatization of reality, and I would like to know somehow if the point is, if I got you right, that the debate about post-truth and populism and all this is somehow also a the elites try to regain their power, to regain the possibility to regulate what is true and what is not true. If that would be the point, my question would be, this privatization of reality, is this maybe also some kind of strategy to say, okay, well, there are new subjects who claim the political stage, but the claims that they make, they are only opinions. They have no relationship to truth. They are just in the private sphere. So I would think, for example, the feminist cause. The feminist cause is a good example for some claims that are until today claims the common sense would say this is mainly a private cause. It's something that has something to do with the home. It's not really a public question. Or maybe one could say also that the question of black people in America are things that are not wanted in the public discourse. And everyone says, well, that's not something we should discuss publicly. This is private. So this is just your personal opinion that you have the feeling you are maybe... that you have the feeling that you are discriminated, this has something to do with your psychology or something like that. So my question would be, is this privatization of reality also a strategy to regain the power of the elites? To say that there is a privatization of reality.
Ah, I see. Okay, yes, I see. I would say no. I would say no. I'm not sure if I get completely your question. When I speak about the privatization of reality, I speak about what each single individual does when he or she speaks publicly. In a way that he or she thinks be normative. So making statement about the world that they think to be true. Why they think to be true, this is a huge problem. But the point is there is an overlapping between the fact that they speak publicly through the tweet or through the Facebook and the fact that the simple fact that their statements are public make them true. I do not believe this is what happens. I do not believe that a statement is true because it's public. I'm just stating that the fact that everybody can do it lead everybody to think that, to use its own argument in a, as if it were true.
I want to introduce the concept of a social lie. There are certain falsehoods that it's useful socially to act as if they were true or as if they had some plausibility. These are very common, and in fact, they are very useful socially. So when Barack Obama was elected President of the United States, it was quite commonly said, now at last, blacks have attained full equality in the United States. That's a social lie. Now, the colossal case was de Gaulle declaring, La France a été libérée par les Français. I mean, it was preposterous, you know. It wasn't just a lie, it was ridiculous. But you talk as if, no, that's like Wittgenstein's example of taking for granted a certain conception of reality, what I call the background. You have, in order to think at all, you have to have a background that's not itself one of the things that's in dispute. And I found your remarks here in the second last paragraph extremely puzzling. I don't know what they mean. I assume de Gaulle committed a social lie. Very common. De Gaulle, when de Gaulle said La France a été libérée par les Français, that was a social lie. He knew it was false, everybody knew it was false, but it was useful to act as if. That went on. Et under the force de France, I went to Amélie, and there they had a wonderful movie set. At every point of the compass, France is defending itself, as if some other, they might any day be bombed from Washington. You know, it wasn't true that point d'azimut. I mean, they were worried about the force de frappe was against obvious enemies in the East. And this is another social lie. And I would like your reaction to the idea that the social lie is not the same as a background presupposition.
Unfortunately, I think that the social lie is a background presupposition. I'm sorry, but the social lie that World War II was can count his among his victor friends, he's an enormous social lie that allows us to constitute Europe. So exactly, social lies are participate in our background. This is, I guess, a matter of fact. And if we want to go back to Wittgenstein's uncertainty, he says something like that when he says, when he speaks about the fact that we could, changing all the documents that we have at our disposal, we could construct a completely false reality that nonetheless we would use as a real, as a useful background. He states that very clearly. So I'm not talking about the fact that social lies are good or bad. I'm talking about another kind of statement that we witness. And it's a singular, particular statement that can be made by any singular individual that can have the presupposition of saying the truth just because it says publicly. And to make my point very clear, I'm concerned about democracy. Okay, this is my whole point. Wow. And not, no, I mean, well, yeah, of course, all we are all conservative, but the point is, if I may say it this way, more democracy than truth, because exactly because of the social lies that you just remembered, and as everybody said this morning, more or less, social lie can be helpful in constructing a good functioning democracy. Okay, so my whole point is just that we should acknowledge that the subjects that participate in public life and especially in democracy are changing their status, and so the regime of the discourse about truth is changing its status.
Okay, yes, we are running out of time, so we should stop here. Thank you, Chiara. Thank you. And we will start at 2:30.